Second similarity among them is self-discipline. North's choice of the Marines epitomizes a life of discipline. As a young boy, he was already obedient to orders. North didn't hang around much. His mother used to blow a whistle for him when it was time to come home. He was more apt to dress neater than we did. Graham grew up in a regimen of diligent pieties in his household. By the time he was 10, he had memorized all 107 articles of the Shorter Catechism. As for Dewey, his lot dropped him straight into a severely disciplined life. When Tommy was 3, he was given a bicycle with the strict admonition that it would be reclaimed if he were to fall off while riding. The child promptly mounted and promptly lost it to his mother's unrelenting grip for a full year. In college, Dewey seems to have abstained from sowing wild oats. Graham was often smitten, was girl crazy, went to the communal spooning ground, kissing girls until my mouth was chapped. But somehow I never engaged in sexual immorality. For some reason, God kept me clean. I never even touched a girl's breast. In high school, North dated infrequently. When he was 10, he and a pal were mistakenly dropped off at a Brigitte Bardot movie. Ollie's eyes fairly bugged out as she steamed across the screen. "There's no way we ought to be seeing this," Ollie reportedly told his pal. So they got up and went to an ice cream parlor instead. I believe that the crucial common denominator shared by these three is their belief. The pure, persuasive power of belief. When Tommy Dewey was 7, he dragged a cart to a neighbor's house and asked if he might collect her old newspapers to sell. At the age of 9, he began selling magazines and newspapers. His dedication was sometimes carried to curious extremes. Tom seemed possessed when he came around selling the Saturday Evening Post, a purchaser remembers. I told him I didn't want the magazine, but he just looked at me defiantly with those dark, piercing eyes and left it on my desk. He gave me a dozen reasons why I should buy it. I couldn't out-argue him. It was easier to become his steady customer. During the drought and depression of the southern summer of 1936, Billy Graham, out of high school, sold Fuller brushes door-to-door in both Carolinas. The area sales manager was absolutely overwhelmed at the Fuller brushes that Billy sold those few weeks. He didn't quite see how just one single human being could possibly sell that many brushes in that space of time. Billy himself professes, "I believed in the product. Selling those little brushes became a cause to me. I felt every family ought to have a Fuller brush as a matter of principle. Sincerity is the biggest part of selling anything, I found out, including salvation." He brought Fuller brushes to his girl as gifts and brushed his own teeth with them so often and so sincerely, his gums started receding. North's product was America itself, rather than its symbolic representations in Fuller brushes and the Saturday Evening Post, and he was equally convinced of its virtue and equally persuasive in his passion. Long before he sold it openly to the United States Senate and on TV, America was his belief. A high school classmate remembers, "One of the guys in school said something about how stupid the Army was. Then he said that we, meaning the U.S., shouldn't get involved in any wars overseas." Well, Larry, Ollie, got pretty mad. He told the guy, "If you don't like living in America, you can just get the hell out." Though the product may represent collective mediocrity, the brush, the magazine, the love-it-or-leave-it patriotism, there is nothing mediocre in selling performance. Habit is character and becomes fate. This high school incident already reveals the Acorn's belief in all the future foreign operations that North subsequently executed. Ambition, high ideals, clean living, long hours. The signs of alpha animals harnessed by the work ethic, pulling big loads of reform uphill. Their values and practices, their tastes and associates may not have risen above the middle brow range, but they nonetheless went to the peaks. By his early 30s, Graham had already seized the popular evangelical imagination, drawing huge crowds of the lost and seeking, and the wealthy too, into his tent. At age 35, Dewey was sworn in as District Attorney of Manhattan, becoming the youngest man ever to hold this title. At 38, he was close to winning the Republican nomination to run against Roosevelt, which he did 4 years later at age 42. He had already busted bosses and bootleggers, racketeers, and hitmen. One after another, they were trapped by his relentless, meticulous prosecutions. Waxy Gordon, Dutch Schultz, Joseph Castellano, the Artichoke King, the Gorilla Boys, the Black Hand, Lucky Luciano, Jimmy Hines, and Louis Lepke of Murder, Inc. Before he was 40, North was moving easily among the Washington power elite. Congressman Michael Barnes reports, he hung out with Henry Kissinger. Ali has a rather remarkable facility for ingratiating himself with important people. Here he was, hobnobbing with Supreme Court justices, generals, and senators, and very relaxed about the whole thing. Ali was more a peer. He arrived with the imprimatur of the White House, and more often than not, he was at Henry's elbow. A few years later, North was in charge of major portions of United States foreign affairs in the Caribbean, Grenada, Central America, and the Middle East, Iran, Libya, and Israel. Graham's operations were also worldwide. As prayer man for Eisenhower, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, and Reagan, he too belonged to the cadre of power. Dewey may have reached fewer people, but in the modern Republican Party, it was he who masterminded the nominations of both Eisenhower and Nixon, two men who dominated America in the middle years of this century. Hardly a life on this planet has not been affirmed or afflicted by the eager actions of these three men of the virtuous middle. They stayed the course, stood for principle, kept tight the purse strings. At 32, Dewey still continued his methodical notation of every 15-cent shoeshine and 85-cent dinner in a tiny pad. When he left the governorship of New York, state taxes were 10% lower than when he had first taken office. Graham, whose cause received giant donations and who golfed with the rich, spends hours, trying to figure out how not to make money, said his wife, Ruth. Each man married the right girl, raised his children, and stood for honesty and, above all, self-control, the idealized habits of Middle America's great white way. Perhaps the one God that provides the common denominator here is just this habit of self-control, but not self-control as such, rather its shadow. Control in service of belief, in particular of a belief that required control over the shadow. This is abundantly clear in North's statements of belief before Congress. There was an enemy to be faced, international communism, and the compromising that weakens the patriotic fiber of America. Things must be put in order. Dewey's target was crime, the gangsters in the dark tenements of Manhattan, the Irish Tammany Hall, the Jewish racketeers, and the Italian mobsters and extortionists. Dewey was cleaning up America, remaking it on the model of his own fastidiousness. Graham's charge was the cleansing of the spirit throughout the world. His enterprise was called a crusade. Control over the weakness and evil in self, and control over evil in others, go together. For Dewey, by convicting criminals to the penitentiaries. For North, by bombing the bad guys in El Salvador, Grenada, and Libya. For Graham, by beating sin and Satan through converting sinners to Christ. In all, belief justifies the control, and the furor agendi, with which the shadow is opposed, whether the shadow be Tammany Hall, or the mullahs of Tehran, or the evil one himself. Is it belief in the cause, or belief in belief itself? When accused of intellectual suicide, Graham answered, I know I just believe. I just know what belief, without question, without reserve, has let God do in my life. I have decided to believe. North lodged his defense of lying to Congress upon the rock of belief in America and its commander-in-chief. The faith that moves mountains becomes its own shadow. The nobility of the ideals hollows out as the belief intensifies. What did Santayana say about fanaticism? It loses the purpose and redoubles the effort. After his unexpected loss to Truman in the 1948 election, Dewey put it behind him. "That's that. I am going to go ahead," he said. And indeed he did, denying by machinations of power the depth of his rejection by the electorate. North's redoubled effort on behalf of his belief included his plan while at Annapolis to alter, or steal, from a closed office after hours, the record of his leg injuries, which might have kept him out of the Marines. In his devotion to his beliefs, each tried to eliminate what might have held him back. This is called denial. Of Graham, his wife said, "Of course he had doubts, but not for long, because he never really entertains them." His ultimate denial followed Nixon's fall from power, and from Graham's grace. So firm was his belief, so unentertaining was he of his doubts, that Graham never picked up on Nixon's shadow. When it growled forth from the Watergate tapes, Graham entered the deepest depression of his life and suffered a crisis of faith. He paced, bit his fingernails, was nauseated, could not sleep. He was temporarily cornered in the contradiction posed by belief, that it requires some sort of suicide, intellectual, moral, perceptual. "I really believed in Nixon as the greatest possibility ever for leading this country on into its greatest and finest days. He had the character for it. I'd never heard him tell a lie." Those tapes revealed a man I never knew. I never saw that side of him. From blindness to denial. In time, Graham recovered from this trial. Faith refound, restored to innocence, he kept on going. The common denominator in all three is the invincibility of belief. Though each can be found morally reprehensible, Graham for his denial, North for his lies, Dewey for his manipulations, belief allowed them to go forward uncorrupted in the midst of dirty doings, untouched by their own shadows, innocent. And I submit that it is precisely this American habit of belief that appeals to our Main Street mediocrity. Therefore, this same component, whether it be named innocence by literary critics, denial by psychologists, or belief by believers, must be the essence of the American character, which accounts for why Dewey, Graham, and North are such eminent representatives of its style. We must also admit, despite our previous judgment against mediocrity as a psychologically valid term, that we have uncovered the psychological condition that generates American mediocrity, the capacity to deny, to remain innocent, to use belief as a protection against sophistications of every sort, intellectual, aesthetic, moral, psychological, keeps the American character from awakening. The American character remains blind to the fact that the virtues of mediocrity, those pieties of disciplined energy, order, self-control, probity, and faith, are themselves messengers of the devil they would overcome. We need to emphasize the exceptional in a society that now, owing to a reverse snobism, is enthralled with the ordinary, with the newly knighted, hard-working, tax-paying, moral, and deserving middle class. If the society suffers a loss of soul, a loss of daimonic inspiration, of angel and genius, then before starting off in search of them, why not ask what might be driving them away? Maybe inviting mediocrity in just doing a passable job as a team player, not upsetting the boat, holding on to family values, joining the Walmart community, staying cool, fearing extremists and ungrounded, underground ideas, is precisely what drives the invisibles away. Why is the exceptional suspect? Do we resist it because we fear inspiration, conceiving it to be an elitist condition of the private mind, privileging communication with spirits over community with peers? And what about a culture that imagines inspiration to be asocial? Will it not cling ever more tenaciously to uninspired mediocrity? Let us not forget that societies are elevated and rewarded by those who are inspired. The emergency nurse, the teacher of the year, the basketball guard who arcs a perfect three-pointer. The inspired moment does not invalidate the team, but belongs to the context of the team and to its wider hometown public. To sink the shot in the final second, and thereby save a crucial game, is not merely an isolated heroic act. It reconstitutes the hero itself within an archetypal context. The hero is the one who performs inspired deeds for the glory of the city and its gods. Our civilization's egocentric, competitive notions of inspired actions make us miss their societal service. Inspiration means simply inbreathing of spirit, not exaltation of the spirited. Some societies require their members to seek inspiration for the sake of the society. For instance, Native American vision quests, sweat lodges, peyote sessions, and dances. Quaker meetings, which attend the appearance of the indwelling spirit. The social philosophy here is that you can best serve others when you are in service to the others. I have not been adulating fame for its own sake, but rather to display the daimon in an enlarging mirror. To use the exceptional person as an example of an idea is not to literalize exceptionality as embodied only in exceptional people. The persons in this book are personifications of the effect of the invisible daimon. They are heightened visibilities of the daimonic phenomenon. These outstanding figures make human the general idea that all lives have an exceptional component that has not been accounted for by the usual psychological and biographical theories. Manolete and Ingmar Bergman, for instance, are availabilities. They are not available for imitation or cloning, but as exhibitions of the daimon. The blessing shown in their lives to such an exceptional degree is a universal phenomenon. It is yours, too. They are enlarged witnesses to the availability of blessing. This old method of magnification aims to inspire the weak and weary to feel again the grandeur latent in the acorn of every man and every woman, no matter their statistical mediocrity. But only after we have invalidated mediocrity as a psychological concept may we legitimately enthuse over exceptionality. Otherwise, such enthusiasm, our name-dropping and our introducing the reader to so many stars, would appear to be snobbish fawning over the famous. So we have kicked the notions of mean, average, middle, and mediocre out of psychology altogether, and back to where they better serve: economics, epidemiology, sociology, marketing, that readers may imagine themselves more in terms of the extraordinary for which the models in this chapter and book serve. North and Graham and Dewey are each exceptional. Whatever clings to them as mediocre comes from snobbish sniggerings at Graham's gabardine suits, or Dewey's little man on the wedding cake look, or North's good boyism. Thereby, we miss the fact that each is faithful to his acorn and exemplifies his particular character, including its vices, in every consistent motion of his conduct. In a society, and at a time when oddballs are shelved in shelters, medicated into serotonin serenity, and recovered by groups from compelling individual intensities, when anything too different becomes marginalized, it becomes especially important for the consciousness of the nation to actively affirm the extraordinary. If eminence depends on fate, and fate on character, then the three terms may also be reversed. To improve character, moral instruction is not enough. We can ignore the exhortations of William Bennett and Alan Bloom, and rather look at fate, and particularly at the fate of the eminent. Their images, their courage, their ambition, and their risk are our instructors. These three extreme representatives of the middle, who fired the faith and political engagements of millions of Americans, do not have middling characters themselves. Images of eminence from the middle show that the middle is also a path. This allows us to grasp the innate value of the middle, rather than sneering at it for its collective, petty bourgeois limitations, or retreating into it for fear of the edge. Despite whatever snobism the chapter may still betray, it is a chapter written with idealism, for I have tried to change mediocrity from a term of contempt into a concept of value, where the daimon may also appear. The word remains a social put-down until we uncover within each example of mediocrity the specific character it carries, the each-ness of the acorn. A Democrat's Platonism. The underlying tension in this chapter is one I have wrestled with for a long time. 25 years ago, maybe more, Gilles Quispel, the Dutch scholar of early Christian gnosis and the sects of the time, and I were sitting beside Lake Maggiore, he puffing his pipe and twinkling with a certain malicious glee, like an old Dutch sea captain from a Conrad novel, when he asked me, "How can you, Hillman, be both a Platonist and a Democrat?" Quispel had glimpsed the daimon of my destiny, and so the question has taken some years to answer. Of course, assumed by the question is a certain common view of Plato and Platonism. That is, that they are totalitarian, elitist, patriarchal, and have laid an authoritative groundwork for the authoritarian state. Quispel's question assumes as well a certain notion of democracy as popularist, secular, and unanchored in transcendence. Democracy may have founding fathers, but not angels. Hence, Quispel's question, how can one embrace elitism and populism, eternal principles and vagaries of persuasion? Or, in the classical language of philosophy, with which Quispel was far more familiar than I, how can one embrace the realms of truth and opinion? This conundrum has bothered Western thinkers as far back as Parmenides. In our nation, the distinction between truth and opinion has solidified into the wall between church and state, between revealed truth and poles of popular opinion. Yet the Declaration of Independence asserts that the American democratic state is founded upon a transcendent truth. All men are created equal. What is the basis of this claim? Inequalities are there before the first breath. Any nurse in the birthing section of a hospital can confirm that inequality exists from the beginning. Infants differ from one another. Genetic studies show innate differences of skills, temperaments, intensities. As for the circumstances into which we descend, what could be more unequal than our environments? Some are disadvantaged, others privileged by nurture and nature both, and from the beginning. Since neither nurture nor nature gives equality, where do we even get the idea? It cannot be induced from the facts of life, nor can equality be reduced to a factor common to all human beings, such as erect posture, symbolic language, or manipulation of fire, because individual differences elaborate the common factor in billions of ways. Equality can only be deduced from uniqueness, from what the scholastic philosophers called the principle of individuality. I am imagining this uniqueness as the hexitas, medieval Latin for this-ness, in the genius as the formative factor given with each person's birth, so that he or she is this one and not some other one, anyone, no one. So equality must be axiomatic, a given, as the Declaration of Independence says that we are equal is a truth self-evident. We are equal by the logic of eachness. Each by definition is distinct from every other each and therefore equal as such. We are equal because each brings a specific calling into the world, and we are unequal in every other respect, unfairly, unjustly, utterly unequal, except in the fact of each's unique genius. Democracy rests, therefore, upon the foundations of an acorn. The acorn pushes beyond the edge. Its principal passion is realization. The calling demands untrammeled freedom of pursuit, a freedom live on arrival, and this freedom cannot be guaranteed by society. If the opportunities for freedom are decreed by society, then society has the superior power, and freedom becomes subject to society's authority. As democratic equality can find no other logical ground but the uniqueness of each individual's calling, so freedom is founded upon the full independence of calling. when the writers of the Declaration of Independence stated that all are born equal, they saw that the proposition necessarily entailed a companion. All are born free. It is the fact of calling that makes us equal, and the act of calling that demands we be free. The principal guarantor of both is the invisible individual genius. Let us forego both reading Plato as a nasty fascist with unreal ideals and imagining democracy as a directionless collection of opinionated victims. Then we may see that Platonism and democracy do not need to repel each other like the ends of opposing magnets, but are both built upon the same charge, the importance of the soul of the individual. Plato's state exists for the sake of that soul, not for the sake of the state, or for any particular group within it. In fact, the main analogy running through his Republic is the parallel between the layers of the soul and the strata of the state. What we do in the state, we do to the soul, and what we do in the soul, we do for the state, if Platonism is carried to term and not aborted before its implications are fully formed. Furthermore, as we have seen in this chapter, the only theoretical guarantor of the individuality required by democracy, and for the sake of whom the American democracy was brought into being, is that same soul, here called angel, acorn, genius, by any name as sweet. Platonism and democracy share a vision of the principal importance of the individual soul. This soul, or daimon, or genius, by the way, also seems to be not only a Platonist in its origins in Plato's own myth, but also a democrat, because it enters the world of interactions. It shows itself in geography, as if to say it so enters the world that it takes on the garments of place, as if it wants to abide in the world and live in its body. Only theologians and shamans dare speak about the invisibles apart from the visible world. Death and another realm are surely not the aim of the acorn's push, but rather the visible world, where it acts as guide. Loss of the daimon collapses democratic society into a crowd of shoppers wandering a mall of mazes in search of the exit. But there is no exit without the guide of an individual direction. So, Professor Crispell, should we meet again under the thick trees? I'd say Platonism and democracy can get along with each other very nicely. Both are based on soul. Both are similarly concerned with how the soul can be in the world and in the best manner fulfilled. To focus on the best and on fulfillment does not force elitism, nor does it abandon democracy. Coda, A Note on Methodology. Is it a mistake to choose an organic metaphor for this theory? Doesn't the very term acorn put us immediately into an organic model of natural growth and attach our theory both to genetic determinism and to evolution through time? Two ideas our theory intends to circumvent, even undermine. Is the theory not being subverted willy-nilly by its own name? The naming of species, of heavenly bodies, of diseases, always entraps the thing named in a root metaphor, claiming it for a worldview, as, for instance, the naming of mountains and islands during the period of colonial explorations. The names of European potentates and heroic scientists colonized all sorts of natural phenomena, planets, plants, processes. Liberation movements cast off the oppression of words that represented the old order. Should we not let go of the residue of evolutionary organicism represented by the word acorn and rename this theory, the essence theory, the image theory, or the genius theory, or even call it boldly the theory of angelic psychology? I hold to acorn because it demonstrates how to read organic images without falling prey to organicism. If we are able to use a natural image in an unnatural way, then we will have shown, by means of the term acorn, the very kernel of our archetypal point of view, which aims to turn the organic, time-bound developmental view of human life backward on itself, to read life against the stream of time. If we want to revise the developmental model of human nature, we may as well take on one of its seed images to begin with. We keep the term, but we shall dislodge it from our usual patterns of thought. It is not the acorn that needs to be discarded, but the habit of thinking of acorns only naturalistically and temporally. However, once the acorn is imagined archetypally, imagined as an archetypal idea, it is not confined by either the laws of nature or the processes of time. A narrow, naturalistic definition of acorn as the seed or fruit of the oak tree establishes only one level of its meaning, giving it only a literal botanical place in the mind. This first level can block others from showing. The acorn also has mythological, morphological, and etymological meanings. The acorn is also a mythical symbol. It is a shape, and it is a word with ancestries, tangents, and implications, and suggestive power. By amplifying acorn in these different directions, as we are now about to do, we will be carried beyond the naturalistic strictures of its standard meaning, and by turning the sense of acorn and expanding its potential, we shall be demonstrating how to turn the biology of the human beyond its organic setting. Let's take the mythological symbolism of oak and acorn for a start. In the ancient Mediterranean and in northern Germanic and Celtic Europe, the oak was a magical ancestor tree. Whatever was closely associated with the oak partook of its power, birds nesting there, gall wasps in its boles, bees and their honey, the entwining mistletoe, and of course, the oak's acorns. Oaks were father trees that drew down firebolts from the sky and belonged to such major gods as Zeus and Donar and Jupiter and Votan. And they were mother trees, proterai materis, first mothers in Greek, giving birth to humans in the various myths that tell tales of how humans first came to be in the world. We are born from acorns, as acorns are born from oaks, and as the words tree and truth are cognates, so the tree in its acorn form bears truth too, in nutze. Such would be a rhapsodic reading of the little cupped pellets lying around the forest floor. Mythological language composes in images what conceptual language states in sentences. The reason acorns are images of primordial personality is that oaks are inhabited by oracular soul figures. Oaks in particular are soul trees because they are the haunts of bees and harbor honey, which was considered in Mediterranean antiquity and in many other parts of the world to be a divine nectar for the gods, an otherworldly primordial soul food. But more significantly, oaks are soul trees because nymphs, diviners, and priestesses lived in or by them, and could express the oak's foreknowledge and understanding of events in hints and sayings. All tall trees are wise, according to the West African teacher Maladoma Somme, because their movement is imperceptible, the connection between above and below so firm, their physical presence so generously useful. The oak, with such size and age and beauty and solidity, would therefore be especially wise, and its acorns will carry all the tree's knowledge compressed into a tiny core, as endless angels of vast awareness can dance on the head of a pin. Invisibles require minimal space, but to some they can speak loud and clear, and they do so from oaks. Whether the speaking was heard in the rustling of wind in the leaves, the creaking of limbs, the rubbing of branches, or without any external, verifiable sensations, it could be interpreted by specially gifted priestesses, as for instance at Dodona in northwestern Greece, already mentioned in Homer. People came to ask the oracular tree about their fate. Embodied in the oak was knowledge of fate, and so an inquirer could ask, Geryatan asks Zeus concerning a wife whether it is better for him to take one. Callicrates asks the god whether I will have offspring from Nike the wife, whom I have by remaining with her, and praying to which of the gods. Cleitus asks Zeus and Dione if it is better and profitable for him to keep sheep. Or, to uncover the more simple yet also stressful mysteries of life, did Dorcalus steal the cloth? Assumed in these oracular oaken practices at Dodona and elsewhere are two facts relevant to our thesis. First, the oak knows what is concealed from ordinary eyes. Second, this knowledge can be revealed to persons, in most cases women, who can hear and let it speak through them. Robert Graves claims that Dodona priestesses, and Gallic druids too, literally chewed acorns to induce prophetic trance. Park, who collected the evidence, does not report the interpreter's answers. What they heard through the tree may have been enormously important to the inquirers. But for our inquiry, what matters is that they heard. The acorn, botanically, is like an angiosperm, a fully endowed embryonic plant. The essence of the oak is all there at once. Theologically, the acorn is like one of Augustine's rationis seminalis, or seminal reasons. As far back as the Stoics, Gnostics, and Platonists, such as Philo, some ancient thought held that the world was filled with spermatokoi logoi, word seeds or germinal ideas. These are present in the world from its beginning as the primordial a priori that gives form to each thing. And these spermatic words make it possible for each thing to tell of its own nature, to ears that can hear. The idea that nature speaks, especially through the voice of a talking oak, remained a vivid fantasy through the ages, and was still a subject of paintings 100 years ago. Awakening to the original seed of one's soul and hearing it speak may not be easy. How do we recognize its voice? What signals does it give? Before we can address these questions, we need to notice our own deafness, the obstructions that make us hard of hearing, the reductionism, the literalism, the scientism of our so-called common sense, for it is hard to get it through our hard heads that there can be messages from elsewhere more important to the conduct of our lives than what comes through Centel and Internet, meanings that don't slide in fast, free, and easy, but are encoded, particularly in the painful, pathologized events that perhaps are the only ways the gods can wake us up. A Scandinavian tale in Jacob Grimm's Teutonic mythology expresses this idea in the language of myth. The big, old giant Skrymir went to sleep under a big, old oak. Thor came and hit him on the head with his hammer. Skrymir woke up wondering if a leaf had fallen on him. He went back to sleep and snored outlandishly. Thor hit him again, harder. The giant again woke up and asked whether an acorn had fallen on his head. He went back to sleep. Thor hit him even a greater blow to his head with that divine hammer. But the giant, rousing himself from sleep, said, "Must be birds up in the tree. They must have dropped on my head." The acorn theory is bird shit to the giant. Giants are notoriously slow-witted, cursed with physical thinking, short-sighted, and always hungry, because they are so empty. Skrymir is our literalist, our reductionist, who never can quite get it. And so the giant is counterpoised in fairy tales with the cunning animal, the elf or gnome, the savvy maiden or the little tailor. These would never equate an acorn with a leaf blown by or a drop of dung. They can pick up a metaphor when they see one, while the giant can only think in onlys, reducing everything to its least common denominator, so that he never has to leave the cave or awaken from his stentorian snoring stupor. Little wonder that when we were very small, we all feared giants and thrilled to stories about those who could kill them, like David or Jack, or outwit them like Ulysses. The giant, with its grown-up stupidity, threatens a child's imagination, a child's ecological connections with a wondrous world. Stupidity is the giant that misses the small things. After all, it's a bean that saves Jack, and a pebble that saves David from Goliath. The giant in the psyche is another name for Plato's cave of ignorance. And so it's in a cave that Ulysses meets Cyclops, the one-eyed giant, who takes literally Ulysses' witty way with words and is thereby fooled. Although the talking oak spoke oracularly through women, and though all trees have been categorized as symbolically female because of their sheltering, nourishing, cyclical behavior, and because they provide the basic hila, or matter, for so many human actions, the oak and the acorn were imagined as particularly male. Not only was the oak a great father god tree, Jupiter in Roman Europe and Donar in the north, but also, and now we move from the mythic to the morphological, because the acorn was called the Juglans, or glans penis of Jupiter. The English language hides from us what many other languages reveal. The smooth head of the penis and its rolled back and cupping foreskin display the shape of an acorn. In German, Eichel means both acorn and glans. In French, the word for both is gland. In Latin, glans. In Greek, balanos. In Spanish, bellota. Medical writers like Celsus and naturalists like Pliny and Aristotle made this equation of penis head and acorn, and fertility rites conjoined the mythological understanding of the oak with the morphological appearance of its fruit. Etymologically, at our third level of elaboration, the word acorn is related to acre, act, and agent. Acorn derives most closely from Old High German, Ackern, fruit, produce, not merely as a seed, but as an already fulfilled fruition. Actus, action, activity, agency, is associated with acorn, so that the acorn must be understood as an accomplished result, and not merely as a beginning, in a developmental sense, of a new tree. The entire order of thinking is reversed. More distantly, acorn comes from the Sanskrit via the Greek ago, agin, and their various forms and derivatives, which mean basically to push, to direct toward, to lead or guide. A chief in Homer is an agos. The imperative agi, agete, means move, get going, go. From this same ancient stem derive your agenda and your agony, the ordinary experience of the pushy acorn in any of our lives. Isn't it surprising to find this cornucopia of verbal riches packed into the acorn? And we're not done yet, because the Greek word for glans penis and for acorn, balanos, derives from balos and bal, meaning that which is cast or falls, like the nut from the tree, or is thrown, like the throw of the dice. And it also means to fling. There is a parallel here between this root, balos, for the fall or throw that may decide your case, and the source of the word case itself, which comes from the Latin caere, to fall. Your case is simply the fate that befalls you, and your case history tells the story of how your lot has been cast. A fatal element lies condensed into the very word acorn, and your life is its project. Cognate with balanos, acorn, is balizon, to throw the leg about, and balitus, a throwing, from which our words ballistic and, via the Romance languages, our ballet and ball as a large dancing event. A primordial loveliness resides in the etymological acorn. It dances with life and is full of projections. And it is as sensitive as the tip of the penis. Moreover, it is ballistic with action. All this we have harvested from its myths, its shape, and its words. It seems precisely the right image for the theory we are examining. The acorn theory of biography seems to have sprung from, and to speak the language of the puer aeternus, the archetype of the eternal youth, who embodies a timeless, everlasting, yet fragile connection with the invisible other world. In human lives, he accounts for the precocious child and the undeniable call of fate, such as we saw in Menuhin and Garland. He appears especially as the dominant archetype in those visionary figures who make their mark early, disturb the commonplace, and vanish into legend, like James Dean and Clyde Barrow and Kurt Cobain, like Mozart and Keats and Shelley, like Chatterton and Rimbaud and Schubert, like Alexander the Great, dead at 30, and Jesus, dead at 33. Like that brilliant boy, Alexander Hamilton, at 18 already a founding father of a revolution and an idealized new nation. Charlie Parker was gone at 35, Bonnie Berrigan at 33, Jimmy Blanton at 23, Buddy Holly at 22. And think of the dead young painters like Jean-Michel Basquiat and Keith Haring. Any of us could make a list, and not only of the celebrated and notorious, but of those elemental young men and women who touched our lives with their promise and then were gone. And of course, the puer aeternus as archetype is beyond gender. Jean Harlow, dead at 26, Carol Lombard at 33, Patsy Cline at 30, Janis Joplin, Eva Hesse, Moira Dwyer, Amelia Earhart. These figures of fame find backing in figures of myth, Icarus and Horace, who flew higher than their fathers, fleet Atalanta, young Lancelot, and Gawain. Marvelous Theseus, Saint Sebastian, pierced through the breast, boy David, sweet singer of psalms, Ganymede, cupbearer of ambrosia on Olympus, and all the luminous lovers, Adonis, Paris, and Narcissus. Colloquial speech calls bright young stars geniuses. Especially relevant to this connection of genius with puer, of glands with acorn, is the Roman primary identity of the genius with procreative phallic power, so that the spontaneity of the penis represents pars pro toto, the genius itself. For this reason, a man may speak of his member as having its own intuitive eye, its own will, and feel that it plays a major role in his fate. Men may fetishize the organ, conferring upon it the mysterious motions of an invisible divinity. This delusional, narcissistic, obsessive, overvalued idea of the penis, in the terms of conventional therapy, can best be accounted for by placing this style of puer phallicism against a background in myth. The puer figure, Baldur, Tammuz, Jesus, Krishna, brings myth into reality. The message is mythical, stating that he, the myth, so easily wounded, so easily slain, yet always reborn, is the seminal substructure of all imaginative enterprise. These figures, like myths themselves, seem not real. They feel insubstantial. Tales of them say they are quick to bleed, fall, wither, vanish. But their devotion to the other world, they are missionaries of transcendence, is never forsaken. Somewhere over the rainbow. La lune, c'est mon pays, says the white-faced clown in the film Les Enfants du Paradis. Loony and lonely, lovely and pale, this is the puer, touching earth tentatively, and of course, promiscuously by the glands of the penis, wanting to be received by the ground. The devotion to an altered state of mind propels puer fantasy toward altering the mind of the state by setting fires of rebellion. The calling from the eternal world demands that this world here be turned upside down to restore its nearness to the moon, lunacy, love, poetics, flower power, Woodstock, Berkeley, the cry of the students of Paris 68, imagination au pouvoir. No gradualism, no compromise, because eternity doesn't make deals with time. Inspiration and vision are results in themselves. But then what happens? Immortal ideals fall to mortality, Kent State, then baby boomers and business. Golden girls and lads all must, as chimney sweepers come to dust. Manolete bleeding in the sand. Not only a biography can be touched by an archetypal figure. There are archetypal styles of theories as well. Any theory that is affected by the puer will show dashing execution, an appeal to the extraordinary, and a show of aestheticism. It will claim timelessness and universal validity, but forego the labors of proof. It will have that puer dance in it, will imagine ambitiously, and rebel against convention. A puer-inspired theory will also limp among the facts even collapse when met with the questioning inquiries of so-called reality, which is the position taken by the Pu'er's classical opponent, the gray-faced king or Saturn figure, old, hard-nose, hard-ass, hard-hat. He wants statistics, examples, studies, not images, visions, stories. Knowing about these constellations and how they affect what we read and how we react to what we read helps readers find where they are on the archetypal map. At one moment entranced by the revolution in ideas, at another thoroughly skeptical of the bullshit. This kind of self-reflection belongs to psychological method. Unlike the methods used by other disciplines when positing their ideas, an archetypal psychology is obliged to show its own mythical premises, how it is begging its first question, in this case the myth of the acorn. Because theories are not merely cooked up in the head or induced from cold data, they represent the dramas of myth in conceptual terms, and the drama is played out in arguments over paradigm shifts. Having uncovered the Pu'er in our method, let us go on with the acorn. Galen, the learned and prolific medical writer, A.D. 129 to 199, confirms the ancient belief that acorns are primordial food, which is a mythical way of saying that you feed off your inner kernel. Your calling is your psyche's first nourishment. Galen said that the Arcadians were still eating acorns, even after the Greeks had learned to cultivate cereals. This is another way of saying that the support of the acorn precedes the practical civilizing effects of your natural mother, the mother world of Demeter Ceres, the nourishing civilizing goddess after whom cereal is named. The acorn is a gift of nature before nurture, but a nature that is mythical and virgin, that is, never known, never grasped. So acorns, according to Sir James George Frazer's compilations, belong to the realm of Artemis, who presided at childbirth. Then, and up into modern times, in French and English poetry and painting, this Arcadia of the acorn was the imaginal landscape of primitive nature, similar to Eden or Paradise, where the untrammeled natural soul lived in accord with nature. Therapy has transplanted Arcadia to childhood. The natural being feeding on acorns, therapy has christened the inner child, replacing the Garden of Eden, filled with animals and serpents and sin and knowledge, as well as replacing the Arcadia of rough acorn eaters with an abused and idealized inner child is an abuse itself. For the pagan mind, you did not go back to childhood, nor did you idolize innocence to recover the idols of free being. You went to Arcadia, an imaginal terrain where we are cared for by our genius. In the acorn lies not only the completion of life before it is lived, but the dissatisfied frustration of unlived life. The acorn sees, it knows, it urges, but what can it do? This discrepancy between seed and tree, between the spindle in the lap of the gods in heaven, and the traffic in the lap of the family on earth, packs the acorn with the fury of incapacity, of reach without grasp. The acorn is like a tiny child, empurpled with rage, because it cannot do what it imagines. Although the inner taste of the acorn may be nourishing, and communion with the angel sweet, the acorn is also bitter. It is astringent and tannic. It shrinks back. Says no, as Socrates' daimon only cautioned negations. Maybe that's why actual acorns must be soaked and leached, boiled and blanched again and again, undergoing long softening before their meat can be ground into palatable flour. As the recipe say, you'll know they're done when they no longer taste bitter. Inside the beautiful pu'er is a terrifying, even toxic, bitterness. See it in the gestures of Basquiat, the sounds of Cobain, Hendrix, Joplin, the suicidal desperation that can't wait into the time of the oak. Theories, too, are afflicted with shadow. The acorn theory, and the extraordinary lift to life that it offers, vision, beauty, destiny, is also a tough nut to swallow. This coda proved to be a necessary and final excursus on method. It tied the acorn theory with its founding image, and tied the founding image yet further out to a mythical configuration called Puer Aeternus. By means of this excursus, I was able to show how one can transplant an organic metaphor from its usual pot in a philosophy of organicism which would have confined our acorn theory in a developmental model of human life. Life is not only a natural process, it is as well, and even more, a mystery. To account for life's occluded revelations by analogies with nature commits a naturalistic fallacy. That is, assuming psychic life obeys only natural laws as described, for instance, by evolution and genetics. Humans ever and again try to crack the soul's code, to unlock the secrets of its nature. But what if its nature is not natural and not human? Suppose what we seek is not only something else, but somewhere else. In fact, having no where at all, despite the call that beckons us to search. There is, therefore, nowhere to look beyond the fact of the call. It seems wiser to attend to the call than to avoid it by searching for its source. The invisibility at the heart of things was traditionally named the Deus absconditus, the concealed God, that could be spoken of only in images, metaphors, and paradoxical conundrums, gems of immense worth buried within giant mountains, sparks that contain the flammable force of wildfire. The most important, said this tradition, is always the least apparent. The acorn is one such metaphor, and the acorn theory draws upon this tradition that goes back to Blake and Wordsworth, to the German Romantics, and to Marsilio Ficino, and Nicholas of Cusa in the Renaissance. As the acorn is one such metaphor of smallness, so too are the daimon and the soul metaphors. They are even smaller than small, because they belong among the invisibles. For the soul is not a measurable entity, not a substance, not a force, even if we are called by the force of its claims. Nothing corporeal at all, says Ficino, and therefore the daimon's nature and the soul's code cannot be encompassed by physical means. Only curious thought, devotional feeling, suggestive intuition, and daring imagination, each a mode of puer knowing. In keeping with a specific archetypal figure of the puer, this theory is meant to inspire and revolutionize, and also to excite a fresh erotic attachment to its subject, your subjective and personal autobiography, the way you imagine your life. Because how you imagine life strongly impinges upon the raising of children, the attitudes toward the symptoms and disturbances of adolescence, your individuality in a democracy, the strangeness of old age and the duties of dying. In fact, upon the professions of education, psychotherapy, the writing of biography, and the life of the citizen. For four Daimones, Baby Jew, Cookie, Mutz, and Boise. This concludes the reading of The Soul's Code in Search of Character and Calling by James Hillman. Copyright 1996 by James Hillman. This book was read by John Lesko. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Melanie Jackson Agency, LLC. And was produced in 2020 by Blackstone Publishing, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Publishing. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.